Adrian nods quickly and disappears into the kitchen. After a minute or so, he comes back with a big toolbox, which he quickly takes to the exit.
"And you be quiet," Uva says to Parvana.
She smirks in a way that suggests she has no intention of keeping quiet.
"I only brought the bicycle here so he wouldn't mess about in the sheds back home," Uva adds.
"Sure, sure," says Parvana with a laugh. "Oh, hey," says Adrian as the soot-eyed boy appears again a moment later. "This is my boss."
"Hi there. What are you doing?"
asks the boss, looking with some interest at the spry stranger who has barricaded himself behind the counter of his cafe.
"The kid's going to fix a bicycle,"
answers Uva, as if this were something plain and obvious.
"Where do you keep the filters for real coffee?"
The soot-eyed boy points at one of the shelves. Uva squints at him.
"Is that makeup?"
Parvana hushes him. Uva looks insulted.
"What? What's wrong with asking?"
The boy smiles a little nervously.
"Yes, it's makeup."
He nods, rubbing himself around his eyes.
"I went dancing last night,"
he said, smiling gratefully as Parvana, with the deftness of a fellow conspirator, hauls out a wet wipe from her handbag and offers it to him. Uva nods and goes back to his coffee making.
"And do you also have problems with bicycles and love and girls?"
he asks absent-mindedly.
No, not with bicycles anyway, and not with love either, I suppose. Well, not with girls anyway,"
he chuckles. Uva turns on the percolator and, once it begins to splutter, turns around and leans against the inside of the counter as if this is the most natural thing in the world in a cafe where one doesn't work.
"Vet, are you?"
"Uva," says Parvana and slaps him on the arm. Uva snatches back his arm and looks very offended.
"What?"
"You don't call it that," Parvana says, clearly unwilling to pronounce the word again.
"Queer,"
Uva offers. Parvana tries to hit his arm again, but Uva is too quick.
"Don't talk like that," she orders him.
Uva turns to the sooty boy, genuinely puzzled.
"Can't one say bent? What are you supposed to say nowadays?"
"You say homosexual or LGBT person,"
Parvana interrupts before she can stop herself.
You can say what you want, it's cool,"
the boy smiles as he walks around the counter and puts on an apron.
"Right, good to be clear. One of those gays, then," mumbles Uva.
Parvana shakes her head apologetically. The boy just laughs.
"Well then,"
says Uva with a nod, and starts pouring himself a coffee while it's still going through. Then he takes the cup, and without another word goes outside and across the street to the parking area. The sooty boy doesn't comment on his taking the cup outside. It would seem a little unnecessary, under the circumstances, when this man, within 5 minutes of his arrival at the boys' cafe, has already appointed himself as barista and interrogated him about his sexual preferences. Adrian is standing by the Saab, looking as if he just got lost in a forest.
"Is it going well?"
asks Uva rhetorically, taking a sip of coffee and looking at the bicycle, which Adrian hasn't even unhooked yet from the back of the car.
"Nah, you know, sort of."
"Well," Adrian begins, compulsively scratching his chest. Uva observes him for half a minute or so, takes another mouthful of his coffee, nods irritably like someone squeezing an avocado and finding it overly ripe. He forcefully presses his cup of coffee into the hands of the boy and then steps forward to unhitch the bicycle, turns it upside down, and opens the toolbox the youth has brought from the cafe.
"Didn't your dad ever teach you how to fix a bike?"
he says, without looking at Adrian while he hunches over the punctured tire.
"My dad's in a slammer,"
Adrian replies almost inaudibly and scratches his shoulder, looking around as if he'd like to find a big black hole to sink into. Uva stops himself, looks up, and gives him an evaluating stare. The boy stares at the ground. Uva clears his throat.
"It's not so bloody difficult,"
he mutters at long last and gestures at Adrian to sit on the ground. It takes them 10 minutes to repair the puncture. Uva barks monosyllabic instructions. Adrian remains silent throughout. But he's attentive and dexterous and in a certain sense does not make a complete fool of himself, Uva has to admit. Maybe he's not quite as fumbling with his hands as he is with words. They wipe off the dirt with the rag from the trunk of the Saab, avoiding eye contact with each other.
"I hope the lady's worth it," says Uva and closes the trunk.
Now it's Adrian's turn to look nonplussed. When they go back into the cafe, there's a short cube-shaped man in a stained shirt standing on a stepladder, tinkering with something that Uwe suspects is a fan heater. The sooty boy stands below the stepladder with a selection of screwdrivers, held aloft. He keeps mopping the remnants of makeup around his eyes, peering at the fat man on the ladder and looking a little on the nervous side, as if worried that he may be caught out. Pravana turns excitedly to Uwe.
"This is Hamel. He owns the cafe," she says in a suitably gushing manner.
She points to the cubic man on the ladder. Hamel doesn't turn around, but he emits a long sequence of hard consonants that, even though Uwe does not understand them, he suspects to be various combinations of four-letter words and body parts.
"What's he saying?"
asks Adrian. The sooty boy twists uncomfortably.
He's something about the fan heater being a bit of a fairy."
He looks over at Adrian, then quickly turns his face down.
"What's that?"
asks Uwe, wandering over to him.
"He means it's worthless, like a homo," he says, in such a low voice that only Uwe catches his words.
Pravana, on the other hand, is busy pointing at Hamel with delight.
"You can't hear what he's saying, but you sort of know that almost all of it is swear words. He's like a dubbed version of you, Uwe."
Uwe doesn't look particularly delighted, nor does Hamel. He stops tinkering with the fan heater and points at Uwe with the screwdriver.
"The cat? Is that your cat?"
"No," says Uwe.
Not so much because he wants to point out that it isn't his cat, but because he wants to clarify that it's no one's cat.
"Cat out! No animals in cafe!"
Hamel slashes at the consonants so that they hop out like naughty children caught inside the sentence. Uwe looks with interest at the fan heater above Amel's head, then at the cat on the bar stool, then at the toolbox, which Adrian is still holding in his hand, then at the fan heater again, and at Hamel.
"If I repair that for you, the cat stays."
He offers this more as a statement than a question. Hamel seems to lose his self-possession for a few moments. By the time he regains it, in a way he could probably not explain afterwards, he has become the man holding the stepladder rather than the man standing on the stepladder. Uwe digs about up there for a few minutes, climbs down, brushes the palm of his hand against his trouser leg, and hands the screwdriver and a little adjustable wrench to the sooty boy.
"You fixed!"
cries Hamel suddenly as the fan heater splutters back to life. In an effusive manner, he grabs Uva's shoulders.
"Whiskey, you want in my kitchen? I have the whiskey."
Uwe checks his watch. It's 2:15 in the afternoon. He shakes his head while looking a little uncomfortable, partly about the whiskey and partly because of Hamel, who is still holding on to him. The sooty boy disappears through the kitchen door behind the counter, still frenetically rubbing his eyes. Adrian catches up with Uwe and the cat on their way back to the Saab.
"Uwe, mate, you won't say anything about Mirsad being..."
"Who?"
"My boss," says Adrian. "The one with the makeup."
"The bent person?" says Uwe.
Adrian nods.
Hamel, he doesn't know Mirsad is..."
Adrian fumbles for the right word.
"A bender?"
Uwe asks. Adrian nods. Uwe shrugs. Pravana comes wagging along behind them, out of breath.
"Where did you get to?" Uwe asks her.
"I gave my change to him,"
says Parvana with a nod at the man with the dirty beard by the house wall.
"You know he'll only spend it on schnapps," Uwe states.
Parvana opens her eyes wide with something Uwe strongly suspects to be sarcasm.
"Really? Will he? And I was so hoping he would use it to pay off his student loans from his university education in particle physics."
Uwe snorts and opens the Saab. Adrian stays where he is on the other side of the car.
"Yes?"
Uwe wonders.
"You won't say anything about Mirsad, will you? Seriously?"
"Why the hell would I say anything?"
Uwe points at him with exasperation.
"You? You want to buy a French car. Don't worry so much about others. You have enough problems of your own."
Chapter 30. A man called Uwe and a society without him. Uwe brushes the snow off the gravestone, digs determinedly into the frozen ground, and carefully replenishes the flowers. He stands up, dusts himself off, and looks helplessly at her name,
feeling ashamed of himself. He who always used to nag at her about being late, now he stands here himself, apparently quite incapable of following her as he'd planned.
"It's just been bloody mayhem," he mumbles to the stone.
And then he's silent again. He doesn't know what happened to him after her funeral. The days and weeks floated together in such a way and in such utter silence that he could hardly describe what exactly he was doing. Before Parvana and that Patrick backed into his mailbox, he could barely remember saying a word to another human being since Sonia died. Some evenings he forgets to eat. That's never happened before, as far as he can remember. Not since he sat down with her on that train almost 40 years ago. As long as Sonia was there, they had their routines. Uva got up at 5:45, made coffee, went off for his inspection. By 6:30, Sonia had showered, and then they had breakfast and drank coffee. Sonia had eggs. Uva had bread. At 7:05, Uva carried her to the passenger seat of the Saab, stowed her wheelchair in the trunk and gave her a lift to school. Then he drove to work. At 9:45, they took coffee breaks separately. Sonia took milk in her coffee, Uva had it black. At 12, they had lunch. At 3:15, another coffee break. At 5:15, Uva picked up Sonia in the school courtyard, hoisted her into the passenger seat and the wheelchair into the trunk. By 6:00, they were at the kitchen table having their dinner, usually meat and potatoes and gravy, Uva's favorite meal. Then she solved crosswords with her legs drawn up beneath her on the sofa while Uva pottered about in the tool shed and watched the news. At 9:30, Uva carried her upstairs to the bedroom. She nagged him for years about moving into the empty downstairs guest room, but Uva refused. After a decade or so, she realized that this was his way of showing her that he had no intention of giving up, that God and the universe and all the other things would not be allowed to win, that the swine could go to hell. So she stopped nagging. On Friday nights, they sat up until 10:30 watching television. On Saturdays, they had a late breakfast, sometimes as late as 8:00. Then they went out to do their errands. The building supply store, furniture shop, and garden center. Sonia would buy potting soil, and Uva liked to look at tools. They only had a small row house with a tiny outside space, yet there always seemed to be something to plant and something to build. On the way home, they'd stop for ice cream. Sonia would have one with chocolate, and Uva one with nuts. Once a year, the shop raised the price by 1 krona per ice cream, and then, as Sonia put it, Uva would have a tantrum. When they got back to the house, she'd roll out the little terrace door onto the patio, and Uva would help her out of the chair and gently put her on the ground so she could do some gardening in her beloved flower beds. In the meantime, Uva would fetch a screwdriver and disappear into the house. That was the best thing about the house. It was never finished. There was always a screw somewhere for Uva to tighten. On Sundays, they went to a cafe and drank coffee. Uva read the newspaper and Sonia talked. And then it was Monday. And one Monday, she was no longer there. And Uva didn't know exactly when he'd become so quiet. He'd always been taciturn, but this was something quite different. Maybe he had started talking more inside his own head. Maybe he was going insane. He did wonder sometimes. It was as if he didn't want other people to talk to him. He was afraid that their chattering voices would drown out the memory of her voice. He let his fingers run gently across the gravestone, as if running them through the long tassels of a very thick rug. He's never understood young people who natter on about finding themselves. He used to hear that nonstop from all those 30-year-olds at work. All they ever talked about was how they wanted more leisure time, as if that was the only point of working, to get to the point where one didn't have to do it. Sonia used to laugh at Uva and call him the most inflexible man in the world. Uva refused to take that as an insult. He thought there should be some order in things. There should be routines, and one should be able to feel secure about them. He could not see how it could be a bad attribute. Sonia used to tell people about the time that Uva, in a moment of temporary mental dislocation in the middle of the 1980s, had been persuaded by her to get himself a red Saab, even though in all the years she'd known him, he'd always driven a blue one. They were the worst 3 years of Uva's life, Sonia tittered. Since then, Uva had never driven anything but a blue Saab.
Other wives get annoyed because their husbands don't notice when they have their hair cut.
When I have a haircut, my husband is annoyed with me for days because I don't look the same, Sonia used to say.
That's what Uwe misses most of all, having things the same as usual.
People need a function, he believes, and he has always been functional. No one can take that away from him.
It's 13 years since Uwe bought his blue Saab 9-5 station wagon. Not long after, the Yanks at General Motors bought up the last Swedish-held shares in the company.
Uwe closed the newspaper that morning with a long string of swear words that continued into a good part of the afternoon. He never bought a car again. He had no intention of placing his foot in an American car unless his foot and the rest of his body had first been placed in a coffin. They should be bloody clear about that.
Sonia had, of course, also read the article, and she had certain objections to Uwe's exact version of events regarding the company's nationality, but it made no difference. Uwe had made up his mind, and now he was fixed on it. He was going to drive his car until either he or it broke down. Either way, proper cars were not being made anymore, he'd decided. There was only a lot of electronics and crap inside them now, like driving a computer. You couldn't even take them apart without the manufacturers whining about invalid warranties. So it was just as well. Sonia said once that the car would break down with sorrow the day Uwe was buried. And maybe that was true.
But there was a time for everything, she also said. Often. For example, when the doctors gave her the diagnosis 4 years ago, she found it easier to forgive than Uwe did. Forgive God and the universe and everything. Uwe got angry instead. Maybe because he felt someone had to be angry on her behalf, when everything that was evil seemed to assail the only person he'd ever met who didn't deserve it. So, he fought the whole world. He fought with hospital personnel, and he fought with specialists and chief physicians. He fought with men in white shirts and the council representatives, who in the end grew so numerous that he could barely remember their names. There was an insurance policy for this, another insurance policy for that. There was one contact person because Sonia was ill and another because she was in a wheelchair. Then a third contact person, so she did not have to go to work. And a fourth contact person to try to persuade the bloody authorities that this was precisely what she wanted, to go to work. And it was impossible to fight the man in white shirts, and one could not fight a diagnosis. Sonia had cancer.
We have to take it as it comes, said Sonia, and that was what they did. She carried on working with her darling troublemakers for as long as she could until Uwe had to push her into the classroom every morning because she no longer had the strength to do it herself. After a year, she was down to 75% of her full working week. After 2 years, she was on 50%. After 3 years, she was on 25%. When she finally had to go home, she wrote a long personal letter to each of her students and exhorted them to call her if they ever needed anyone to talk to. Almost everyone did call. They came to visit in long lines. One weekend there were so many of them in the row house that Uwe had to go outside and sit in his tool shed for 6 hours. When the last of them had left that evening, he went around the house, carefully assuring himself that nothing had been stolen.
As usual.
Until Sonia called out to him not to forget to count the eggs in the fridge. Then he gave up. Carried her up the stairs while she laughed at him. He put her in the bed, and then, just before they went to sleep, she turned to him, hid her finger in the palm of his hand, burrowed her nose under his collarbone. God took a child from me, darling Uwe, but he gave me 1,000 others. In the fourth year, she died. Now he stands there, running his hand over her gravestone again and again, as if he's trying to rub her back to life.
I'm really going to do it this time. I know you don't like it. I don't like it either, he says in a low voice.
He takes a deep breath, as if he has to steel himself against her trying to convince him not to do it.
See you tomorrow,
he says firmly, and stamps the snow off his shoes, as if not wanting to give her a chance to protest. Then he takes the little path down to the parking area, with the cat padding along beside him. Out through the black gates around the Saab, which still has the learner plate stuck to the back door, he opens the passenger door. Ravonna looks at him, her big brown eyes filled with empathy. I've been thinking about something, she says carefully, as she puts the Saab into gear and pulls off.
Don't,
but she can't be stopped.
I was just thinking that maybe I could help you clean out the house, maybe put Sonia's things in boxes, and...
She hardly has time to speak Sonia's name before Uva's face darkens, anger stiffening it into a mask.
Not another word,
he roars with a booming sound inside the car.
But I was only think...
Not another bloody word, have you got it?
Pravana nods and goes silent. Shaking with anger, Uva stares out the window all the way home. Chapter 31. A man called Uva backs up a trailer. Again. The next morning, after letting the cat out, he fetched Sonia's father's old rifle from the attic. He decided that his dislike of weapons could never be greater than his dislike of all the empty places she has left behind in their silent little house. It was time now. But it seems that someone, somewhere, knows the only way of stopping him is to put something in his way that makes him angry enough not to do it. For this reason, he stands now in the little road between the houses, his arms defiantly crossed, looking at the man in the white shirt, and saying,
I'm here because there was nothing good on the TV.
The man in the white shirt has been observing him without the slightest hint of emotion through the entire conversation. In fact, whenever Uva has met him, he has been more like a machine than a person, just like all the other white shirts Uva has run into in his life. The ones who said Sonia was going to die after the coach accident, the ones who refused to take responsibility afterwards, and the ones who refused to hold others responsible, the ones who would not build an access ramp at the school, the ones who did not want to let her work, the ones who went through paragraphs of small print to root out some clause, meaning they wouldn't have to pay out any insurance money, the ones who wanted to put her in a home. They had all had the same empty eyes, as if they were nothing but shiny shells walking around, grinding away at normal people and pulling their lives to pieces. But when Uva says that thing about there being nothing good on TV, he sees a little twitch at the temple of the white shirt. A flash of frustration, perhaps? Amazed anger, possibly? Pure disdain, very likely. It's the first time Uva has noticed that he's managed to get under the skin of the white shirt, of any white shirt at all. The man snaps his jaws shut, turns around, and starts to walk away. Not with the measured objective steps of a council employee in full control, but something else. With anger, impatience, vengefully. Uva can't remember anything having made him feel so good in a long, long time. Of course, he was supposed to have died today. He had been planning to calmly and peacefully shoot himself in the head just after breakfast. He tidied the kitchen and let the cat out and made himself comfortable in his favorite armchair. He'd planned it this way because the cat routinely asked to be let out at this time. One of the few traits of the cat that Uva was highly appreciative of was its reluctance to crap in other people's homes. Uva was a man of the same ilk. But then, of course, Parvana came banging on his door as if it were the last functioning toilet in the civilized world, as if that woman had nowhere to wee at home. Uva put the rifle away behind the radiator so she wouldn't see it and start interfering. He opened the door, and she more or less had to press her telephone into his hand by violent means before he accepted it.
What is this? Uva wanted to know.
The telephone held between his index finger and his thumb, as if it smelled bad.
It's for you, groaned Parvana, holding her stomach and mopping sweat from her forehead, even though it was below freezing outside. That journalist.
What do I want with her telephone?
God, it's not a telephone. It's my telephone. She's on the line,
Parvana said impatiently. Then, before he could protest, she squeezed past him and headed for his bathroom.
Yes,
said Uva, lifting the telephone to within a couple of inches of his ear, slightly unclear about whether he was still talking to Parvana or the person at the other end.
Hi,
yelled the journalist woman Lena. Uva felt it might be wise to move the phone farther away from his ear.
So, are you ready to give me an interview now?
She went on in a gung-ho tone.
No,
said Uva, holding the telephone in front of him to work out how to hang up.
Did you read the letter I sent you, or the newspaper? Have you read the newspaper? I thought I'd let you see it, so you can form an impression of our journalistic style.
Uva went into the kitchen, picked up the newspaper and letter that Adrian Fellow had brought over a few days earlier.
Have you got it?
Roared the journalist woman.
Calm yourself down, I'm reading it, aren't I?
Uva said out loud to the telephone and leaned over the kitchen table.
I was just wondering if,
she continued valiantly.
Can you calm down, woman?
Uva raged. Suddenly, out of the window, Uva noticed a man in a white shirt and a Skoda driving past his house.
Hello,
the journalist woman called just before Uva flew out the front door.
Oh, dear, dear,
Parvana mumbled anxiously when she came out of the bathroom and caught sight of him careering along between the houses. The man in the white shirt got out of the Skoda on the driver's side outside Rune and Anita's house.
It's enough now, you hear? You're not driving your car inside the residential area, not another bloody yard. You got it?
Shouted Uva in the distance, long before he'd even reached him. The little man in the white shirt, in a most superior manner, adjusted the cigarette packet in his breast pocket while calmly meeting Uva's gaze.
I have permission.
Like hell you do.
The man in the white shirt shrugged as if to chase away an irritating insect more than anything.
And what exactly are you going to do about it, Uva?
The question actually caught Uva off balance. Again. He stopped, his hands trembling with anger, at least a dozen pieces of invective at his disposal. But to his own surprise, he could not bring himself to use any of them.
I know who you are, Uva. I know everything about all the letters you've written about your wife's accident and your wife's illness. You're something of a legend in our offices, you should know,
said the man in the white shirt, his voice quite unwavering. Uva's mouth opened into a crack. The man in the white shirt nodded at him.
I know who you are, and I'm only doing my job. A decision is a decision. You can't do anything about it. You should have learned that by now.
Uva took a step towards him, but the man put up a hand against his chest and pressed him back, not violently, not aggressively, just softly and firmly as if the hand did not belong to him but was directly controlled by some robot at the computer center of a municipal authority.
Go and watch some TV instead, before you have more problems with that heart of yours.
On the passenger side of the Skoda, the determined woman wearing an identical white shirt stepped out with a pile of paper in her arms. The man locked the car with a loud bleep. Then he turned his back on Uva as if Uva had never stood there talking to him. Uva stayed where he was, his fists clenched at his sides and his chin jutting out as if he were an outraged bull elk. The white shirts disappeared into Anita and Rune's house. It took a minute before he recovered himself enough to even turn around. But then he did so with determined fury and started walking towards Parvana's house. Parvana was standing halfway up the little road.
Is that useless husband of yours at home?
Uva growled, walking past her without waiting for an answer.
Parvana didn't have time to do more than nod before Uva, in four long strides, reached their front door.
Patrick opened it, standing there on crutches, casts apparently covering half of his body.
Hi, Uva, he called out cheerfully, trying to wave with the crutch, with the immediate effect that he lost his balance and stumbled into the wall. That trailer you had when you moved in, where did you get it?
Uva demanded. Patrick leaned with his functioning arm against the wall, almost as if he wanted it to look as if he'd meant to stumble into it.
What? Oh, that trailer. I borrowed it off a guy at work.
Call him. You need to borrow it again.
And this was the reason why Uva did not die today, because he was detained by something that made him sufficiently angry to hold his attention. When the man and woman in the white shirts come out of Anita and Rune's house almost an hour later, they find that their little white car with the council logo has been boxed into the little cul-de-sac by a large trailer. A trailer that someone, while they were inside the house, must have parked exactly so it blocks the entire road behind them. One could almost think it had been done on purpose. The woman looks genuinely puzzled, but the man in the white shirt immediately walks up to Uva.
Have you done this?
Uva crosses his arms and looks at him coldly.
Nope.
The man in the white shirt smiles in a superior manner, the way men in white shirts who are used to always having things their own way smile when someone tries to disagree with them.
Move it at once.
I don't think so, says Uva.
The man in the white shirt sighs as if the threatening statement he makes after that were directed at a child.
Move the trailer, Uva, or I'll call the police.
Uva shakes his head nonchalantly, pointing at the sign farther down the road.
Motor vehicles prohibited inside the residential area. It says so clearly on the sign.
Don't you have anything better to do than standing out here pretending to be the foreman? Groans the man in the white shirt.
There was nothing good on TV, says Uva. And that's when there's a little twitch at the temple of the man in the white shirt. As if his mask has slipped a little, just a fraction.
He looks at the trailer. His boxed-in Skoda, the sign. Uva standing in front of him with his arms crossed.
The man seems to consider for an instant whether he might try to force Uva by violence. But he realizes in another instant that this would very likely be an extremely bad idea.
This was very silly of you, Uva. This was very, very silly, he hisses finally.
And his blue eyes, for the first time, are filled with genuine fury. Uva's face does not betray the slightest emotion. The man in the white shirt walks away, up towards the garages and the main road, with the sort of steps that make it clear that this will not be the end of this story. The woman with the papers hurries off after him. One might have expected Uva to watch them with a look of triumph in his eyes. He would probably have expected this himself, in fact, but instead he just looks sad and tired, as if he hasn't slept in months, as if he hardly has the strength to keep his arms up any longer. He lets his hands glide into his pockets and goes back home. But no sooner has he closed the door than someone starts banging on it again.
They're going to take Rune away from Anita, says Parvana urgently, snatching the front door open before Uva has even reached the handle.
Bah! Uva snorts tiredly. The resignation in his voice clearly takes both Parvana and Anita, who's standing behind her, by surprise. Maybe it also surprises Uva. He inhales quickly through his nose, looks at Anita. She's grayer and more sunken than ever. Her eyes are red, swollen.
They say they'll come and pick him up this week and that I can't manage to take care of him myself, she says in a voice so fragile that it hardly manages to get past her lips. We have to do something, cries Parvana, grabbing him.
Uva snatches his arm back and avoids her eyes. Pah, they won't come to get him for years and years. This'll go to appeal and then it'll go through all the bureaucratic shit, says Uva. He tries to sound more convinced and sure of himself than he actually feels. But he doesn't have the strength to care about how he's coming across. He just wants them to leave.
You don't know what you're talking about, roars Parvana.
You're the one who doesn't know what you're talking about. You've never had anything to do with the county council. You don't know what it's like fighting them,
he answers in a monotone voice, his shoulders slumped.
But you have to talk,
she begins to say in a faltering voice. It's as if all the energy in Uva's body is draining out of him even as he stands there. Maybe it's the sight of Anita's worn-out face. Maybe it's the insight that a simple battle won is nothing in the greater scheme of things. A boxed-in Skoda makes no difference. They always come back, just like they did with Sonia, like they always do, with their clauses and documents. Men in white shirts always win. And men like Uva always lose people like Sonia, and nothing can bring her back to him. In the end, there is nothing left but a long series of weekdays with nothing more meaningful than oiling the kitchen counters. And Uva can't cope with it anymore. He feels it in that moment more clearly than ever. He can't fight anymore. Doesn't want to fight anymore. Just wants it all to stop. Parvana keeps trying to argue with him, but he just closes the door. She hammers at it, but he doesn't listen. He sinks down on the stool in the hall and feels his hands trembling. His heart thumps so hard that it feels like his ears are about to explode. The pressure on his chest, as if an enormous darkness has put its boot over his throat, doesn't begin to release till more than 20 minutes later. And then Uva starts to cry.
Chapter 32. A man called Uva isn't running a damned hotel. Sonia said once that to understand men like Uva and Rune, one had to understand from the very beginning that they were men caught in the wrong time. Men who only required a few simple things from life, she said, a roof over their heads, a quiet street, the right make of car, and a woman to be faithful to. A job where you had a proper function. A house where things broke at regular intervals, so you always had something to tinker with.
All people want to live dignified lives. Dignity just means something different to different people, Sonia had said.
To men like Uwe and Rune, dignity was simply that they'd had to manage on their own when they grew up,
and therefore saw it as their right not to become reliant on others when they were adults. There was a sense of pride in having control, in being right, in knowing what road to take and how to screw in a screw, or not. Men like Uwe and Rune were from a generation in which one was what one did, not what one talked about. She knew, of course, that Uwe didn't know how to bear his nameless anger. He needed labels to put on it, ways of categorizing. So when men in white shirts at the council, whose names no normal person could keep track of, tried to do everything Sonia did not want, make her stop working, move her out of her house, imply that she was worth less than a healthy person who was able to walk, and assert that she was dying, Uwe fought them, with documents and letters to newspapers and appeals, right down to something as unremarkable as an access ramp at a school. He fought so doggedly for her against men in white shirts that in the end, he began to hold them personally responsible for all that happened to her and to the child. And then she left him alone in a world where he no longer understood the language. Later that night, once Uwe and the cat have had their dinner and watched the TV for a while, he turns out the lamp in the living room and goes upstairs. The cat follows watchfully at his heels, as if sensing that he's going to do something it hasn't been informed about. It sits on the bedroom floor while Uwe gets undressed and looks as if it's trying to figure out a magic trick. Uwe goes to bed and lies still while the bloody cat, on Sonia's side of the bed, takes more than an hour to go to sleep. Obviously, he does not go to such lengths because of some lingering sense of obligation to the cat. He just doesn't have the energy for an argument. He can't be expected to explain the concept of life and death to an animal that can't even take care of its own fur. When the cat finally rolls onto its back on Sonia's pillow and starts snoring with an open mouth, Uwe sneaks out of bed as light-footedly as he can. Goes down into the living room, gets out the rifle from the hiding place behind the radiator. He gets out four heavy-duty tarpaulins he's fetched in from the tool shed and hidden in the broom cupboard so the cat doesn't notice them. Starts taping them up on the walls in the hall. Uwe, after some consideration, has decided that this will probably be the best room for the deed because it has the smallest surface area. He's assuming that there's a good deal of splattering when one shoots oneself in the head, and he's loath to leave more of a mess behind than he has to. Sonia always hated it when he made a mess. He's wearing his going-out shoes and suit again. It's dirty and still smells of car exhaust, but it'll have to do. He weighs the rifle in his hands as if checking its center of gravity, as if this will play a decisive role in the future of the venture. He turns and twists it, tries to angle the barrel, almost as if intending to fold the weapon double. Not that Uwe knows very much about weapons, but one wants to know if it's a decent piece of equipment one's got, more or less. And because Uwe supposes one can't test the quality of a rifle by kicking it, he decides it can be done by bending and pulling at it to see what happens. While he's doing this, it strikes him that it was probably a fairly bad idea to put on his best gear. Will be an awful lot of blood on the suit, Uwe imagines. Seems silly. So he puts down the rifle, goes into the living room, gets undressed, carefully folds up the suit, and puts it neatly beside his going-out shoes. Then he gets out the letter with all the instructions for Parvana and writes, "Bury me in my suit," under the heading Funeral Arrangements, and puts the letter on top of the pile of clothes. He has already stated clearly and unmistakably that there should not be any fuss in other respects. No exaggerated ceremony and rubbish like that. Shove him in the ground next to Sonia, that's all. The spot has already been prepared and paid for, and Uwe has put cash in the envelope for the hearse. So, wearing nothing but his socks and underwear, Uwe goes back into the hall and picks up his rifle. He catches sight of his own body in the hall mirror. He hasn't seen himself in this way for probably 35 years. He's still quite muscular and robust, certainly in better shape than most men of his age. But something's happened to his skin that makes him look like he's melting, he notes. It looks terrible. It's very quiet in the house, in the whole neighborhood, actually, everyone's sleeping. And only then does Uwe realize
that the cat will probably wake at the sound of the shot. We'll probably scare the living daylights out of the poor critter, Uwe admits. He thinks about this for a good while before he determinedly sets down the rifle and goes into the kitchen to turn on the radio. Not that he needs music to take his own life, and not that he likes the idea of the radio clicking its way through units of electricity when he's gone. But because if the cat wakes up from the bang, it may end up thinking that it's just a part of one of those modern pop songs the radio plays all the time these days. And then go back to sleep. That is Uwe's train of thought. There's no modern pop song on the radio, Uwe hears, when he comes back into the hall and picks up the rifle again. It's the local news bulletin. So he stays where he is for a moment and listens. Not that it's so important to listen to the local news when you're about to shoot yourself in the head, but Uwe thinks there's no harm in keeping yourself updated. They talk about the weather, and the economy, and the traffic, and the importance of local property owners staying vigilant over the weekend because of a large number of burglary rings on the rampage all over town. Bloody hooligans, Uwe mutters and grips the rifle a little more firmly when he hears that. From a purely objective point of view, the fact that Uwe was wielding a gun was something two other hooligans, Adrian and Mersad, would ideally have been aware of before they unconcernedly trotted up to Uwe's front door a few seconds later. They would then quite likely have understood that when Uwe heard their creaking steps in the snow, he would not immediately think to himself, "Guests, how nice," but rather, "Well, I'll be damned." And they probably also know that Uwe, wearing nothing but socks and underpants, with a three-quarter century old hunting rifle in his hands, would kick the door open like an aging half-naked suburban Rambo. And maybe then Adrian would not have screamed in a high-pitched voice that went right through every window on the street, nor would he have turned in panic and run into the tool shed, almost knocking himself unconscious. It takes a few confused cries and a good deal of tumult before Mersad has time to clarify his identity as that of a normal hooligan, not a burglar hooligan, and for Uwe to come to grips with what is happening. Before then, he has had time to wave his rifle at them, making Adrian scream like an air raid warning.
"Shush! You'll wake the bloody cat!"
Uwe hisses angrily while Adrian reels backwards, a swelling as large as a medium-sized pack of ravioli on his forehead.
"What in the name of God are you doing here?"
he raves, the gun still firmly fixed on them.
"It's the middle of the bloody night!"
Mersad is holding a big bag in his hand, which he gently drops into the snow. Adrian impulsively holds his hands up as if he's about to be robbed and almost loses his balance and falls into the snow again.
"It was Adrian's idea," Mersad begins, looking down into the snow.
"Mersad came out today, you know," Adrian blurts out.
"What?"
"He came out, you know, told everyone he was,"
says Adrian, but he seems slightly distracted, partly by the fact that a fuming old man in his underpants is pointing a gun at him, and partly because he is increasingly convinced that he sustained some sort of concussion. Mersad straightens up and looks at Uwe with more determination.
"I told my dad I'm gay."
Uwe's eyes grow slightly less threatening, but he doesn't lower his rifle.
"My dad hates gays. He always said he'd kill himself if he found out that any of his children were gay," Mersad goes on.
After a moment's silence, he adds, "He didn't take it so well, you might say."
"He throwed him out,"
Adrian interjects.
"Through,"
Uwe corrects. Mersad picks up his bag from the ground and nods anew at Uwe.
"This was a stupid idea. We shouldn't have disturbed—"
"Disturb me with what?"
Uwe cuts him short. Now that he's standing here in his underpants and below freezing temperatures, he might as well at least find out the reason why, it seems to him. Mersad takes a deep breath, as if he's physically shoving his pride down his throat.
"Dad said I was sick and not welcome under his roof with my unnatural ways," he says,
swallowing hard before he manages to spit out the word unnatural.
"Because you're a bender?"
Uwe clarifies. Mersad nods.
"I don't have any relatives here in town. I was going to stay the night at Adrian's, but his mom's new boyfriend is staying."
He goes quiet. Looks like he's feeling very silly.
"It was an idiotic idea,"
he says in a low voice and makes a move to turn around and leave. Adrian, on the other hand, seems to be rediscovering a desire for discussion, and he stumbles eagerly through the snow towards Uwe.
"What the hell, Uwe? You've got a load of space in there, so we thought maybe he could crash here tonight."
"Here? This is not a damn hotel,"
says Uva, raising the rifle so that Adrian's chest collides right into the barrel. Adrian freezes. Mursad takes two quick steps forward through the snow and puts his hand on the rifle.
We had nowhere else to go, sorry,
he says in a low voice while gently turning the barrel away from Adrian. Uva looks like he's coming to his senses, slightly. He lowers his weapon to the ground, when he almost imperceptibly takes a half step backwards into the hall, as if he's only now become aware of the cold which envelops his not-so-well-dressed body, he notices from the corner of his eye, the photo of Sonia on the wall. The red dress, the bus trip to Spain when she was pregnant. He asked her so many times to take that bloody photo down, but she refused. Said it was a memory worth as much as any other.
Obstinate woman.
So this should have been the day Uva finally died. Instead, it became the evening before the morning when he woke with not only a cat, but also a bent person living in his row house. Sonia would have liked it, most likely. She liked hotels. Chapter 33. A man called Uva, and an inspection tour that is not the usual. Sometimes it is difficult to explain why some men suddenly do the things they do. Sometimes, of course, it's because they know they'll do them sooner or later anyway, and so they may as well just do them now. And sometimes it's the pure opposite, because they realize they should have done them long ago. Uva has probably known all along what he has to do, but all people, at root, are time optimists. We always think there's enough time to do things with other people, time to say things to them, and then something happens, and then we stand there holding on to words like if. As he marches down the stairs the next morning, he stops in the hallway. It hasn't smelled like this in the house since Sonia died. Watchfully, he takes the last few steps down, lands on the parquet floor, and stands in the doorway of the kitchen, his body language that of a man who has just caught a thief red-handed.
Is that you, who's been toasting bread?
Mursad nods anxiously.
Yes, I hope that's okay. Sorry. I mean, is it?
Uva notices that he's made coffee, too. The cat is on the floor eating tuna. Uva nods, but doesn't answer the question.
Me and the cat have to go for a little walk around our road, he clarifies instead.
Can I come?
Asks Mursad quickly. Uva looks at him a little as if Mursad has stopped him in a pedestrian arcade dressed up as a pirate and asked him to guess under which of the three teacups he's hidden the silver coin.
Maybe I can help.
Mursad continues eagerly. Uva goes into the hall and shoves his feet into his clogs.
It's a free country,
he mutters as he opens the door and lets out the cat. Mursad interprets this as, of course you can, and quickly puts on his jacket and shoes and goes after Uva.
Hey, guys,
Jimmy hollers as they reach the pavement. He turns up, puffing energetically behind Uva in a fiercely green tracksuit that's so tight around his body that Uva wonders at first if it's in fact a garment or a body painting.
Jimmy,
says Jimmy, panting and offering Mursad his hand. The cat looks as if it would like to rub itself lovingly against Jimmy's legs, but seems to change its mind, bearing in mind that the last time it did something similar, Jimmy ended up in the hospital. Instead, it opts for the next best available thing and rolls about in the snow. Jimmy turns to Uva.
I usually see you walking around about this time, so I was going to check with you if you're cool with me tagging along. I decided to start exercising, you know?
He nods with such satisfaction that the fat under his chin sways between his shoulders like a mainsail in stormy conditions. Uva looks highly dubious.
Do you usually get up at this time?
Shit, no, man, I haven't even gone to bed yet,
he laughs. And this is why a cat, an overweight allergy sufferer, a bent person, and a man called Uva make the inspection round that morning. Mursad explains in brief that he and his father are not getting along, and that he's temporarily staying with Uva. Jimmy expresses disbelief that Uva is up at this time every single morning.
Why did you have a fight with the old man, then?
Asks Jimmy.
That's none of your business, Uva barks.
Mursad gives Uva a grateful glance.
But seriously, man, you do this every morning? Jimmy asks cheerfully.
Yes, to check if there have been any burglaries.
For real? Are there a lot of burglaries around here?
There are never lots of burglaries before the first burglary,
Uva mutters and heads off towards the guest parking.
The cat looks at Jimmy as if unimpressed by his fitness drive. Jimmy pouts and touches his stomach in the apparent belief that he has already lost some weight.
"Did you hear about Room, then?"
he calls out, hastening his steps into a half-jog behind Uva. Uva doesn't answer.
"Social services is coming to pick him up, you know,"
Jimmy explains once he's caught up. Uva opens his pad and starts noting down the license plates of the cars. Jimmy evidently takes his silence as an invitation to keep talking.
"You know, the long and short of it is, Anita applied for more home help. Rune has just passed it and she couldn't deal with it anymore. So then the social did some investigation and some guy called and said they decided she couldn't handle it, and they were going to put Rune in one of those institutions, you know? And then Anita said they could forget about it. She didn't even want home help anymore. But then that guy got really aggro and started getting totally uncool with her, going on about how she couldn't take the investigation back now and she was the one who had asked them to look into it. And now the investigation had made a decision and that was all there was to it, you know? Doesn't matter what she says because the social guy is just running his own race, know what I mean?"
Jimmy goes silent and nods at Mursad in the hope of getting some kind of reaction.
"Uncool," Mursad declares hesitantly.
"Bloody uncool,"
Jimmy nods until his upper body shakes. Uva puts his pen and pad in the inside pocket of his jacket and steers his steps towards the trash room.
It'll take them forever to make those kinds of decisions. They say they're taking them now, but they won't pull their finger out for another year or two," he snorts.
Uva knows how that damn bureaucracy works.
"But the decision is made, man," says Jimmy and scratches his hair.
"Just sodding appeal it, it'll take years," says Uva grumpily as he strides past him.
Jimmy looks at him as if trying to evaluate whether it's worth the exertion of following him.
"But she has done. She's been writing letters and things for 2 years.
Uva doesn't stop when he hears that, but he slows down. He hears Jimmy's heavy steps bearing down on him in the snow.
2 years, he asks without turning around.
"More or less," says Jimmy.
Uva looks like he's counting the months in his head.
"That's a lie. Then Sonia would have known about it," he says dismissively.
"I wasn't allowed to say anything to Sonia. Anita didn't want me to, you know."
Jimmy goes silent, looks down at the snow. Uva turns around, raises his eyebrows.
"I know what?"
Jimmy takes a deep breath.
"She thought you had enough troubles of your own,"
he says in a low voice. The silence that follows is so thick you could split it with an axe. Jimmy does not look up, and Uva doesn't say anything. He goes inside the trash room, comes out, goes into the bicycle shed, comes out. The penny seems to have dropped. Jimmy's last words hang like a veil over his movements, and an unfathomable anger builds up inside Uva, picking up speed like a tornado inside his chest. He tugs at doors with increasing violence, kicks the thresholds, and when Jimmy, in the end, mumbles something about,
"Now it's all screwed, man, now they'll put Rune in a home, you know,"
Uva slams a door so hard that the entire trash room shakes. He stands in silence with his back to them, panting more and more heavily.
"Are you okay?"
asks Mursad. Uva turns and points with anything but controlled fury at Jimmy.
"Was that how she put it? She didn't want to ask for Sonia's help because we had enough troubles of our own?"
Jimmy nods anxiously. Uva stares down at the snow, his chest heaving under his jacket. He thinks about how Sonia would have taken it if she'd found out, if she'd known that her best friend had not asked for her help because Sonia had enough problems. She would have been heartbroken. Sometimes it's hard to explain why some men suddenly do the things they do, and Uva had probably known all along what he had to do, whom he had to help before he could die. But we are always optimists when it comes to time. We think there will be time to do things with other people and time to say things to them, time to appeal. Again, Uva turns to Jimmy with a grim expression.
2 years?
Jimmy nods. Uva clears his throat. For the first time, he looks unsure.
"I thought she just started. I thought I had more time," he mumbles.
Jimmy looks as if he's trying to figure out who Uva is talking to. Uva looks up.
"And they're coming to get Rune now? Seriously? No bureaucratic rot and appeals and all that shit? You're sure about this?"
Jimmy nods again. He opens his mouth to say something, but Uva has already started moving off, He makes off between the houses with the movements of a man about to take his revenge for a deadly injustice in a Western. Turns off at the house at the end of the road, where the trailer and the white Skoda are still parked, banging at the door with such force that it's difficult to tell whether it will open before he reduces it to wood chips. Anita opens in shock. Uwe steps right into her hall. Have you got the papers from the authorities here?
Yes, but I thought...
Give them to me. In retrospect, Anita will tell the other neighbors that she had not seen Uwe so angry since 1977, when there was talk of a merger between Saab and Volvo. Chapter 34. A man called Uwe and a boy in the house next door. Uwe has brought along a blue plastic deck chair to push into the snow and sit on. This could take a while, he knows. It always does when he has to tell Sonia something she doesn't like. He carefully brushes away all the snow from the gravestone so they can see each other properly. In just short of 40 years, a lot of different kinds of people have had time to pass through their block of row houses. The house between Uwe's and Rune's had been lived in by quiet, loud, peculiar, unbearable, and hardly noticeable kinds of people. Families have lived there whose teenage children pissed on the fence when they were drunk, or families who tried to plant non-approved bushes in the garden, and families who got the idea that they wanted to paint their house pink. And if there was one single thing Uwe and Rune agreed on, irrespective of how much they were feuding at the time, it was that whoever currently populated the neighbor's house tended to be utter imbeciles. At the end of the 1980s, the house was bought by a man who was apparently some sort of bank manager. As an investment, Uwe heard him boast to the real estate agent. He, in turn, rented the house to a series of tenants in the coming years. One summer, to three young men who made an audacious attempt to redefine it as a free zone for a veritable parade of drug addicts, prostitutes, and criminal elements. The parties went on around the clock, broken glass from beer bottles covered the little walkway between the houses like confetti, and the music boomed out so loud that the pictures fell off the wall in Sonia and Uwe's living room. Uwe went over to put a stop to the nuisance, and the young men jeered at him. When he refused to go, one of them threatened him with a knife. When Sonia tried to make them see sense, the following day, they called her a paralyzed old bag. The evening after, they played louder than ever, and when Anita, in pure desperation, stood outside and shouted at them, they threw a bottle that went right through her and Rune's living room window. And that was obviously quite a bad idea. Uwe immediately began working on his plans for revenge by examining the financial doings of their landlord. He called lawyers and the tax authorities to put a stop to the renting of the house, and he intended to persist with it even if he had to take the case all the bloody way to the Supreme Court, as he put it to Sonia. But he never had time to get that idea off the ground. Late one night, he saw Rune walking towards the parking area with his car keys in his hand. When he came back, he had a plastic bag, the contents of which Uwe could not determine, in his hand. And the following day, the police came and took away the three young men in handcuffs and charged them with possession of a large amount of drugs, which, after an anonymous tip-off, had been found in their shed. Uwe and Rune were both standing in the street when it happened. Their eyes met. Uwe scratched his chin.
"Me, I wouldn't even know where to buy narcotics in this town," said Uwe thoughtfully.
"On the street behind the train station," said Rune, with his hands in his pockets.
"At least that's what I've heard," he added with a grin.
Uwe nodded. They stood, smiling there, in the silence for a long time.
"Car running well?" asked Uwe eventually.
"Like a Swiss watch," Rune smiled.
They were on good terms for 2 months after that. Then, of course, they fell out again over the heating system, but it was nice while it lasted, as Anita said. The tenants came and went in the following years, most with a surprising amount of forbearance and acceptance from Uwe and Rune. Perspective can make a great deal of difference to people's reputations. One summer halfway through the 1990s, a woman moved in with a chubby boy of about 9, whom Sonia and Anita immediately took to their hearts. The boy's father had left them when the boy was newborn, Sonia and Anita were told. A bull-necked man of about 40 who lived with them now and whose breath the two women tried to ignore for as long as possible was her new love. He was rarely at home, and Anita and Sonia avoided asking too many questions. They supposed that the girl saw qualities in him that they perhaps did not understand. "He is taking care of us, and you know how it is. It's not easy being a single mother,"
she said with a brave smile at some point.